Coming up, got Andrew Sharp reacting to everything we saw on opening night of the NBA. And then later in the show, Ace Bailey talks with me before his debut with the Utah Jazz. That's all coming up right now. The NBA's back to discuss opening night. Andrew Sharp. Andrew, how you doing, man?
I am doing great. I had so much more fun than I expected to have on opening night. And I expected to have a lot of fun. But man, oh man, Rockets Thunder was just spectacular. And I'm happy to be here.
I know. It was an awesome game. I mean, what a debut for the NBA on NBC to get a double overtime thriller on opening night. We saw the rings given out. Katie boo yep. during the introductions got me super hyped up. And then SGA, really slow start before he turned into the MVP in the fourth and in overtime. There was drama. Katie missed free throw at the end of regulation. Then the Chris Webber moment in overtime and clutch buckets on both sides by Şengün and SGA. And SGA pirouette, triple, you know, quadruple spin into a drawn foul to win the game. 125
from SGA and a game-winning free throw. I hope he leads into just being a super villain, because him winning the game on a free throw was a perfect coda to last year's Thunder run. It's funny. I started hating on SGA in some text messages midway through the second half, because he was very quiet. And I was a Thunder hater last year, made peace with the Thunder this offseason. They were my pick to repeat as title winners this year. I think they're just stacked across the board, and I'm done fighting reality with the Oklahoma City Thunder. But my passions as a Thunder hater were awakened during the first three quarters of that game, and Shea was just kind of out there, not doing very much. And so I sent a text message hating on him, and lo and behold, he just dominated down the stretch, and of course wins it with a game-winning free throw, because that's just the way life works. Shea is always going to go to the line, and we all just have to accept that that's what greatness looks like in 2025. Here we are.
I mean, he doesn't necessarily have like a patent move yet, but living at the free throw line for him, it's because he's so herky-jerky. I mean, KD did foul him. KD played poor defense on that last possession.
I can't even be mad at the refs. Yeah, exactly. You know, Shea baited KD. KD played good defense to cut off the drive, and then he tried to contest every move that Shea was making, and he should have just relaxed and trusted that I'm 7 feet tall. I'm going to make Shea take this jump shot to beat us. And unfortunately, KD was like twice Shea's size and trying to shadow him all over the floor. Did not end well, but a great game overall. Honestly, I mean, Şengün also just an absolute animal throughout that game. Really impressed me. And NBC, they had me at the player intros. The second they showed the intros and KD was getting booed by everybody, Steven Adams getting love from the OKC fans, like in that moment, I was extremely psyched to watch opening night. And then the game itself delivered on all fronts.
I absolutely did. It was an amazing, amazing first game of the night. And I think one of my main takeaways from this game, we'll talk about both sides, is on the OKC side, we see no Jalen Williams. Chet Holmgren just couldn't miss the start of the game. 28-7-2. Kayson Wallace had 14-7-5-4 steals. He looked like he got taken a third-year leap. A.J. Mitchell, who we saw playing the finals for OKC during his rookie season, had 16 points in the game. He looked like more like the guy who is a star in college. And I come away from this game wondering, Andrew, could Oklahoma City be even better this season?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because obviously they're going to have that depth, which most of the league just doesn't have. I did find myself thinking back to some of the shakier playoff games they had last year, where you look out there and there just aren't very many offensive weapons that scare you. There were long stretches of this game where I was like, well, where is OKC's offense going to come from? And how many of these guys do I trust offensively? And obviously that's without Jalen Williams and without J-Dub, they're a different team. Chet, though, if Chet gets much better, like 15 to 20% better than what we saw a year ago, then yeah, they're definitely going to have a higher ceiling offensively, and they're going to be just as scary defensively. And the role players to me are all more or less interchangeable. Like Kayson Wallace, a lot of people love Kayson Wallace. OKC internally really loves Kayson Wallace. I think he's like 21 or 22 years old, and he can get better. But really, I think the improvement will be directly attributable to Chet Holmgren. And if he could be the guy that he was last night, all season long and in the playoffs, because last year's playoffs, he had his moments, but he wasn't necessarily leading the charge. It was really all about Shea and J-Dub. But if he becomes the sort of guy who's like really part of the big three there, they are going to be very, very scary all year. This is why I'm done fighting reality with the Thunder. This is a budding dynasty. It is what it is.
I mean, definitely. I mean, has the potential to be a budding dynasty. And I think, you know, with the guys we saw on the floor, like there's obvious improvement, right? But there's one thing that happened in the pregame conversation with Tracy McGrady had asked a question to Jalen Williams, who they were interviewing. And they had asked him, you know, so what are you doing to get better during this whole rehab process? Like, what are you trying to accomplish? And J-Dub is like, well, I've spent a lot of time on my offhand. And yep. With J-Dub, he is very much better driving towards his right when it comes to getting to the basket. So with J-Dub, if he's also experiencing some improvement as a result of his not being able to use his right hand during these workouts, maybe you get some improvements from him as well. And so you see this young 68-win team that goes all the way and wins the finals. I'm not saying they're going to win 70 when they're definitely, like, sometimes you do, as you said, wonder where's the offense coming from. They didn't shoot well in game one of the season. But this team has so many lanes to get better over the course of the year. And that's where, like, the dynasty potential talk is pretty obvious and self-explanatory with OKC.
Yeah, there's no question about it. The other thing that I wonder after game one of OKC is, are we not giving enough credit to the Houston Rockets for making them look uncomfortable and making offense look hard for a team that won like 50% of its games by double digits last year, probably more than 50% last year. Because the Rockets, they're starting five is average 6'10". It's like four power forwards and one center. And I was really, really impressed with how physical they were, how active they were, just kind of harassing OKC. They were crashing the boards really effectively on offense. That might have been the only effective thing I saw from the Rockets offense, because there were some possessions where it's like, holy, I cannot believe this is the plan in Houston. But I come away from that game for Houston. Obviously, they sort of let a win get away. They had a number of opportunities to close it in regulation and in overtime. And, you know, KD missed a free throw. He had some bad turnovers. He probably should have lost the game at the end of the first overtime with the attempted timeout, the Chris Webber situation you mentioned. But I come away feeling encouraged about the possibilities for the Rockets, with the caveat that they are probably going to need to make a trade to get a point guard in there to help alleviate the pressure on our guy, Reed Sheppard.
Well, we'll talk about Reed in 1 second, but like I think with him, I want to talk about Amen Thompson first, because he is the starting point guard on the team. And so with Houston, you mentioned the offensive rebounding and, you know, how double big is continuing to work for them. Şengün was amazing, 39-11-7. It didn't matter if it was Chet Holmgren or Isaiah Hartenstein or Alex Caruso. It just seemed like he always found ways to score and just, you know, finagle his way to the basket. He was hit more three-pointers than he ever has in a game. And it kind of carries over what we saw in Eurobasket with the increased frequency and comfortability from three-point range. And that's huge for him. I think with Houston, in their half-court offense at times, especially with that 6'10" average height starting lineup, I'm a little bit surprised we didn't see more run through KD, especially in the second half. And with Amen Thompson, how they would operate without Fred VanVleet was my big question entering the game. I feel a bit more optimistic than I think you do, Andrew, because I think with Amen Thompson, he goes 0-for-7 from three in the game. And despite that, against this elite defense of Oklahoma City, I thought Şengün, Amen Thompson still did a solid job overall creating some quality offensive chances despite an ugly start and despite an ugly end. They're going against the best. Like it's not going to get harder than this. And even then, I thought Amen did a pretty good job in the game despite shooting like crap. 0-for-7 from three, and he had his foot on the line on one of his deep attempts. I think Houston's offense looks a little bit better than I anticipated, to be honest with you.
That's a good call. I remember the foot on the line. It was really 1-for-8 as far as Amen Thompson and his performance on the perimeter. I love that he kept shooting them, number one. And number two, somebody on Twitter compared him to Zion Williamson, where he's so fast and so strong that he's able to create space and defenses have to give him room on his drives because he's just going to blow by them. And so it doesn't necessarily matter as much that he's not a shooter and not somebody that they're worried about in that regard. And I thought we really saw that all night long. And this is why, if I'm a Rockets fan today, yeah, it would have been really cool to get that win on opening night. But by the same token, if Amen is going to be that much better and that much more aggressive this year, they're in really good shape. If Şengün is going to take a step and become like a rock solid all-NBA guy who's just awesome every single night, they're in really good shape. And I also, my worry about Houston this year was, all right, are they going to be asking KD to just do everything and solve every problem and assume too many responsibilities at this point in his career? And I thought they answered that question in game one. I mean, yeah, they could have run more stuff through KD in the second half, but I actually liked that we got down the stretch and I felt pretty comfortable with everything that Şengün was doing and everything that Amen Thompson was doing. And I think that's a really good sign when you couple all that with how physical and awesome they're going to be on defense. Like that team is going to be exhausting to play all year long. So, I'm excited to see what the season turns into for them.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think the length they have, they played a lot of zone, 28 possessions of zone defense in the game compared to 79 mm-hmm. man-to-man possessions. Adam Şengün continued to do the things that you expected to do. Amen Thompson got hurt midway through the game. Hopefully it's not a long-term thing, though it did
yeah,
definitely
it looked like
affect
cramps.
Him down the stretch. Yeah, I think it was just that as well. But ultimately, I think, you know, with OKC, with Houston, it's still, you know, replacing Fred VanVleet. Part of that is Amen Thompson. Part of that is more usage for Alperen Şengün. Part of that is our boy, Reed Shepherd. And Reed Shepherd in the game, Andrew, we are both Reed Shepherd supporters. He was 9 points on 3 of 11 from the floor in 27 minutes. But the big issue defensively, they just attacked our boy, Reed Shepherd, over and over and over and over again. Every time he was on the floor and he wasn't able to contain the ball on the perimeter. And for Houston, it felt like he was the weak link defensively of a group that has really no weak links. And Reed Shepherd, I think, really got spotlighted, rightfully so, by Oklahoma City by that game. Or have you soured on our boy, Reed Shepherd?
Well, he is our boy. Can I tell you how I became a Reed Shepherd believer,
please,
Kevin?
Please.
So it's your fault. It's entirely your fault that I'm a Reed Shepherd believer. The Wizards had the number one pick, had the number two pick last year. And I was, you know, doing my due diligence. These days I'm covering tech, I'm covering China, I'm covering hoops on Greatest of All Talk. So I don't have time to watch college basketball. So Wizards get number two, and I start doing my due diligence. I like what I'm seeing from Reed Shepherd. But I see, you know, a 6'1 white kid. I don't know if I'm really going to use a top three pick on that sort of player. And but I liked everything I saw, like the Tennessee game from Reed Shepherd at Kentucky. Like he looked fantastic. And the idea of what he brings to the table made a lot of sense to me. So like 48 hours before the draft, you were on with Bill Simmons. And you just went all in on Reed Shepherd. And I heard that and I was like, you know what? I need to trust my instincts. The Wizards should take Reed Shepherd. He's going to be at worst a very helpful member of a starting lineup. And there's a little bit of superstar upside in there. You know, if he comes in and is just nailing threes off the dribble for his entire career, he could be really, really excellent in the modern NBA. Obviously, his rookie year starts and he's just MIA all year long last year. The Rockets were in a different place. They're not trying to play a rookie all year. So it's understandable, but a little bit disappointing, particularly since he was really good in Vegas Summer League as a rookie. And then Van Vliet gets hurt, and I start telling myself, you know, don't trust Reed Sheppard to be the solution in Houston. He was completely MIA last year. In Vegas, there were some games this past summer where I was like, I don't know. He's struggling a little bit more than I would like. And then last week, you tweeted highlights from Reed Sheppard against the Pistons. And I watched his preseason highlights, and I was like, nope, I need to trust my instinct again. Reed Sheppard is going to be awesome. Let's go all in on Reed Sheppard. And then last night, so again, that's your fault for surfacing the Pistons highlights.
I apologize.
And then last night, I mean, it's tough. There are a couple things that freak me out as a Reed Sheppard believer. He got pinned and like trapped by the OKC defense way more often than any rotation player should.
How many times did he pick up his dribble, Andrew? It just felt like so almost many every times. Time he put it on the floor,
so many
right?
times. I felt like I was watching like a JV basketball player, and it was just concerning. So that's number one. Obviously, the defense, the on-ball defense. What I liked about Reed Sheppard at Kentucky was he was really active and would create turnovers, and I thought he wouldn't be a problem defensively. But boy, oh boy, he was a problem defensively against the Thunder. And then also, I thought offensively, his processing of the floor was pretty bad. Like, he looked sped up, and he was missing open teammates, forcing bad passes. This is the
feels
worst
like he's
possible
pressing,
matchup
Andrew.
For him.
He's yeah. pressing. It just feels like he's in his own head. He's not playing free. And I'm not trying to make excuses here. It's just the reality of watching this version of Reed Sheppard compared to the moments last year when he scores 25 points against OKC in an April game compared to the G yep. League when he's dropping 40 bombs. It's like there's a difference. And compared to Kentucky as well, there's a difference in that guy compared to the guy who's sharing the floor with Kevin Durant and Alperen Şengün and all those other guys out there. It just feels different. And I think 100%. With Reed, you know, the defense is – one thing. I'm almost less concerned about the defense as I am about the picking up the ball when he has it in his hands aspect. And the fact that at Kentucky, over half of his shots were three-pointers, and he made over half of his threes. He has not yeah. quite looked like an elite shooter in the NBA yet, and that's what he needs to be. If he's shooting 3-for-11 from the floor, with most of those being three-point attempts, he has to make 40%+ from three, and that's what opens up those attacking closeout opportunities where he can use his creativity as a passer and easier creation mm-hmm. chances. He is not a traditional point guard. He is not going to be an on-ball stopper. I think those things are very clear, and this is just further evidence of that. But what he can be is, in my opinion, an elite connective piece if the yeah. shot's falling. And like, if the shot's not falling,
well, and he also,
that's where the conversation is going
to
come.
Better decisions. Yeah, and I want him to yeah. make better decisions because I guess at worst, he could be a Peyton Pritchard type piece of a rotation, but I wanted him to be better than that. And I do think that, I mean, are you selling your Reed Sheppard stock? Let's
ask that as a
threshold question.
I might even buy the dip a little bit here this morning, Andrew. I mean, the stock down a little bit. I might buy the dip because, look,
I don't know.
People are so down on him today after opening night, but he did play. But he did play 27 minutes. And when Amen Thompson went out, who went in? Reed Sheppard. That
See,
at least shows
here
some
you
investment.
Go again. You're pulling me back in. I like 90 seconds ago would not have considered buying the dip on Reed Sheppard stock, but maybe I should, because I think what we've seen from Reed Sheppard is that when he's got the car keys, he is more comfortable and more confident in the decisions he's making. He's more comfortable as a shooter, number one, but he's also just better at striking the balance between scoring and creating. And when he's on the floor with Şengün and Kevin Durant and Amen Thompson, he's struggling to pick his spots in terms of when to assert himself, and he is forcing it a little bit. But that's a solvable problem, and I'm not giving up hope after game one, particularly since OKC has made all kinds of guards look horrible at various stretches. I mean, even Anthony Edwards looked pretty lost in the Western Conference Finals last year. Not saying Reed Shepard's going to be Anthony Edwards ever, but I do want to give it some time before we fully bury Reed Shepard. I'm not selling my stock. It did last night, though. I wrote in my notes, it seems like he needs to shoot 50% from three to make this a worthwhile bargain for the Rockets. And that's a pretty high bar to clear if you're talking about a guy who's going to play 30 minutes a game. But I don't know. He's got to be a better shooter than we've seen, than we saw last night and through long stretches of last season as well. I think that's in there.
Absolutely. Got to be better. I'm not giving up hope. I'm buying the dip, Andrew. I'm buying the dip. I'm planting my flag. I'm buying more stock in Reed Shepard, even if it continues.
I don't know if
down.
I'm buying more stock, but I'm not giving up hope just yet. And I'm excited about the Rockets. I mean, like, what a weird ass team. Yeah, good. Yeah. Probably better ways to invest it, but go for it.
Probably are. I mean, overall, though, I'll tell you what. You know, maybe you should buy the rocket ship in Alperen Şengün and get more some stock in him, because he looked like a superstar for many, many long stretches last night until SGA went off. He looked like the best player on the floor. Let's move on to the Lakers and Warriors, the second game of the night. Because Rockets Thunder went into double overtime, that game started a little late. We didn't enter that game until the middle of the second quarter, and I watched it in full the following morning. So this morning I watched Lakers-Warriors, 119-109 Warriors win. Warriors' big three was excellent. Buddy Hield, early season all-star again. Kuminga looked great. We'll talk about the Warriors more in a second, but I want to start with the Lakers, Andrew, because Luka, 43-12-9, incredible. Austin Reeves, 26-9-5, looked great. The rest of the team, awful. They looked awful. DeAndre Ayton, just completely invisible at times defensively.
What can you say?
Just frustrating watching him play so timid offensively. He had said a few weeks ago how he hasn't really practiced with Luka. It sure looked like it. The defense was just bad. No containment. I come away feeling like the Warriors, the deeper,
speechless,
better team. The Lakers, it looked like Luka Reeves and nobody else.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny because before we came on to record, you misspoke and said we're going to lead with Lakers Warriors. And I had a momentary panic because I was like, I don't know what you say about Lakers Warriors, because the Lakers are just a bad team right now. If you don't have LeBron James in the lineup, kind of anchoring things on defense, like, people forget the final 2.5 months of the season after the Luka trade, LeBron was super important to everything that they were doing defensively, and was a huge reason that they weren't just outright horrible defensively. And I thought it was one of the more impressive stretches of like the last couple years of LeBron James, because he was sacrificing, he was doing the little things, he was playing the four, and he was basically holding the defense together with his bare hands. Remove him from the mix, the defense is going to be horrendous all year. And, you know, Luka and Reeves can score, but they're not going to be able to just do this all by themselves. And you look at the rest of the rotation for the Lakers, there are some big names. I'll love Marcus Smart until the day I die. Rui Hachimura is not terrible. He's at least a recognizable name. DeAndre Ayton, former number one pick. Like, there are names, but that's a bad team that I saw on Thursday night, on Tuesday night. And I don't know how many solutions there are, because I don't have any faith in DeAndre Ayton to suddenly turn the corner and become more physical and be the imposing presence that they need at the five. I mean, some of the Ayton stuff I saw in the preseason and certainly last night had me wondering, like, are we positive he is an upgrade over Jackson Hayes, who was unplayable in the playoffs last year. So it
that
was
says
a pretty
a lot,
grim...
that thought even crosses your mind, Andrew.
And isn't that crazy? Exactly. Like, but at the same time, like, Ayton just physically doesn't look like the guy he was 3 years ago when the Suns went to the finals. Like, it's just a completely different player, and he's taking
like
a lot of like fadeaways. Yeah, like mid-range fadeaways and stuff. Like, that's not what
no,
the Lakers want.
He has no post bag at all.
Yep.
And there was a stretch in that third quarter where the Warriors really built their lead, where they kind of kept going to Ayton. I'm like, what are we doing
Ayton.
Here? What is going on? He has no game on the post. Why are you continuing to go to DeAndre Ayton? It's just the weirdest thing, man. And I feel like as the center on this team where LeBron's missing, you got to be the tone setter. And there was a possession in the first half where Luka found Ayton on a short roll and Ayton scored on it. And then he just kind of lollygags back on defense. The Warriors beat them up the floor after a made Lakers basket. And
yeah,
that's in the first half of the game and countless situations in the second half where I felt like Ayton missed rotations. And not to put it all on him, it's everybody in the team. It's not just Ayton. But when you're
everybody
the center,
everybody missed
back
rotations.
Line, yes.
It was
but
bad
the center,
defense.
The center needs to be a tone setter. And that's where I felt like he wasn't providing what he had to do. And then you're J.J. Redick and you're looking down the bench. And in the second half, Luka plays the whole second half. And he's already dealing with a groin issue from the preseason. So game one, you're playing your star player dealing with an issue for the whole second half. And I just feel like with this team, it's because they don't have a lot of other answers. And J.J. Redick is probably already feeling that, where it's like, we can't rely on our defense. It's Luka and Reeves, and that's it. That's all.
I can't believe he played Luka the entire second half. Like, I really don't understand the thinking there, because that game was out of reach for most of the second half. I mean, like, obviously the Lakers could come back. It's not like they should just forfeit midway through the third quarter. But it was pretty clear that the Lakers didn't have it. And if you're J.J. Redick, it's like, you got to play for 82 games. And, you know, I just don't understand why you would play Luka as much as he played Luka. And they're going to be asking a lot of Luka all year long. He's in better shape this year. And I don't know. I don't know what the answers are for that team. I think it's going to be rough. And I also have no idea what's going on with LeBron James. And I think that there's some weirdness there that makes it even more ominous when you look back at that opening game, because it's not like LeBron's going to come back in 3 weeks and everything's going to be fine. I would imagine it's going to be a more complicated path than that.
Yeah. So LeBron is sitting on the bench for the entire game. And every time cameras pan to him, or every time, even just when the broadcast camera would move side to side, he just did not react at all. Our friend Dumman Rangula,
we've got Dumman's tweet up there.
Dumman yes. posted, I agree with every word from this. Dumman said, "I'm not a body language doctor by profession, and this is just one man's observation. LeBron was disconnected all night, not interacting with the team, coaches, or what was taking place on the court all game. Don't kill the messenger. Ooh. Just reporting what I saw, and every word of that is 100% accurate. Everything."
Yep.
LeBron was not reacting to anything. He looked like he was just staring into space, like he didn't want to be there. Like he's in a waiting room at a doctor's office, just waiting to be called. And just, I think for LeBron, you just see his face with the photo on screen here. That was the whole night. He just looked like he did not want to be there. And to me, it's just strange with this sciatica issue, some of the rumblings out there, and then this behavior on game one of the season. Very odd, Andrew. Something's up.
There was a great stretch. In the second half, Noah Eagle at one point, Luka had a wonderful highlight. And then Eagle said, LeBron looking pleased on the bench. And they panned to LeBron. And I think it might have been this shot. He wasn't pleased. He was just sitting there looking pissed off, maybe a little constipated and just miserable the entire time. And detached. Most importantly, detached from what was happening on the court with his teammates. And look, I don't know whether the sciatica thing is real. I just, The facts are what the facts are. In July, Rich Paul sent a weird statement to Shams and ESPN saying that essentially LeBron is in a different phase than the Lakers and they might need to make a move. And nothing happened. And LeBron didn't speak for the rest of the summer. And now training camp started. He didn't practice. There's this sciatica injury. And it just seems like he is pissed off at the team for not giving him the extension and or not moving him after not giving him the extension. And it the mood seems like it's going to be a problem for the majority of the year. Maybe LeBron will surprise everybody and come back healthy. I mean, if the injury is real, sciatica is kind of concerning in its own right. So I have no idea what exactly is happening there. But if I were a Lakers fan, I would be filled with dread after what I saw on opening night. And it's a shame because like last year when Luka got there, there was, you know, some showtimey vibes in some of the regular season games they had. Obviously, they crash and burn in the first round against the Wolves. But those regular season games were legitimately thrilling at points. And I don't think it's going to go that direction. I don't think thrilling is going to be the adjective we use for this year's Lakers. Maybe it's an overreaction after one game, but the cupboard looks pretty bare right now.
I'll tell you what, my main thought from LeBron, this whole saga, everything this summer, everything you just described and everything we saw on opening night, the Lakers will have to move either him or Reeves. Otherwise, this team has no chance to contend this season. If they want to contend this
good
year,
take.
One of those guys has to go. And they need to find some balance on this roster with more wings, more length, a different big would be nice. Make Ayton your backup instead. And ultimately, wouldn't shock me if that's what ends up happening, whether it is LeBron or Reeves. It's just a matter of finding a suitor. I'm sure a lot of teams will love Austin Reeves. I don't think there's a lot of teams that would want LeBron, and there's not a lot of teams that he would want either. But I can't. I mean, maybe it's just a too much body language doctor stuff, but I can't help but think that this aligns with exactly the actions that we saw this summer with the Rich Paul quote. The going public is weird. I mean, that just came out of nowhere, right? Like we're not aligned
super
here.
Weird.
And maybe they're not aligned, right? Like the Lakers, there's been plenty of leaks from the Lakers side saying, oh, they're more thinking about 26, 27 with Luka and beyond. And that this year is about a kind of a transition year. Well, if that's the case and you're LeBron James in year 23, over 40 years old, then yeah, you aren't aligned. And maybe that's what this is all about. Whether the injury's real or exaggerated in order to rest and come back late, this is an observation period for LeBron James. And if I'm LeBron, like Lakers fans, I hate what I saw on opening night. And I would not feel like this is a team that has championship potential, even with inserting LeBron James, still a top 10-ish player, back onto the team. He doesn't solve the issues with this team, with defense especially. He helps a little bit, but you're asking LeBron to do his best Draymond impression all regular season in order to get the sixth seed or the seventh seed?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem realistic to me, and I just look at this team and do wonder if maybe he sees the end of the relationship, and that's just the reality of it, and that we do get some Shams bomb midway through the year. LeBron James has demanded a trade to blank.
Oh, boy.
Knicks, Cavs, yeah. Warriors. I don't know who it would be, but it just wouldn't shock me if that's where this is going.
Well, and part of what makes it so fun and dysfunctional is I think the Lakers are also sick of LeBron James. I think a mutual distaste at this point because LeBron is pissed off at the Lakers.
Luka's there now.
Totally. They're ready to build around Luka. And, you know, having LeBron James on your team imposes all kinds of burdens on a management structure. And I think they're just tired of dealing with the drama year in and year off. I mean, that's what I heard over the summer. And it is what it is. If they were to move Luka, if they were to move LeBron, I wonder whether any team can fit his salary on their books. And it's tough. Whether if it breaks really bad, it turns into more of a buyout situation halfway through the season as opposed to trading him for like Darius Garland and Jared Allen. That was being thrown out in game one. LeBron for Darius Garland and Jared Allen. Always a good sign when people are throwing out fake trades halfway through your season opener. But like, if I'm Cleveland, I just don't make that move. I think that would be crazy from the Cavs standpoint, but we'll
see. I want to win it without LeBron if I'm the Cavs. I want to win the championship without him. That's just my personal, if I were a Cavs fan, that's how I would feel. I would want to see them do it with that group, without LeBron James. I think the buyout situation, I had Bobby Marks on last week. The buyout route is complicated because of teams in the apron that wouldn't be able to sign him. So be very interesting to see how this plays out. On the Warriors, on the Warriors side of things in this, four players with 17 or more points. Will Richard, rookie in his first game, came off the bench, looked like the same guy we saw win a national title at Florida. He looked great, bringing energy, hitting shots. Really impressive from him. Jonathan Kuminga. Oh, this whole saga all summer. Game one. During the broadcast, Noah Eagle and Grant Hill were talking about how they had a conversation with Steve Kerr, and they had asked him, you know, how do you imagine, what player you want, do you want Kuminga to play like? And he just said Sean Marion, which we've heard from Kerr before. Kuminga looked like he was embracing it in game one. Yep. 9 rebounds in the game. He was cutting and moving and passing the ball. Like, he looked great. It really was impressive.
Does the Kuminga apology need to be as loud as the disrespect was? A lot of shots taken at Kuminga, including internally from the Warriors. But he was great. And I'm hoping that that's the Kuminga we get all year. I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm sure there will be some rough Kuminga games as well. The reality of the Kuminga is when his jumper is falling, he looks awesome and like somebody that can be a member of a contending nucleus. And when the jumper escapes him, he just doesn't do very much to help. But I thought he played in the flow of the offense very, very effectively. I was surprised when I saw that the Warriors were going to be starting him, and he answered the bell, man. So, yeah, I think with Golden State, they just looked excellent across the board on opening night, and it made me very excited for what the season can turn into for them. And I think health is the only question I have with the Warriors, but if those guys are healthy, they're going to be one of the three or four best teams in the West. And since the West is basically like the varsity conference, three or four best teams in the league. Let's just call it like that.
You'd go that far. So three or four would, you know, we're talking OKC, Denver, Minnesota, Houston. You'd put Golden State in that same group or above some of those teams.
I would put them in that group. I would say they're like the fourth team that I feel really good about in the West. And maybe the Clippers can sneak in there as well as a regular season team. But the Clippers, I'm not going to be putting any faith in the Clippers once we get to the playoffs. So it's those four teams in the West. And then I would add the Cavs as the fifth team that I take very, very seriously. Not quite there with the Knicks, though, for instance.
One of the other trends from both games in game, and we talked about Reed Shepard getting attacked. There was moments throughout the Warriors-Lakers game as well where just Jimmy Butler just kept going at Gabe Vincent over and over on post-ups. And I feel like with the NBA nowadays, there's a decrease in playing time and touches for guys who are 6'3 and shorter. And we saw that opening night. And so that's just something that I have on my mind, Andrew, when it comes to, you know, these next guys that are entering the NBA, but even just the guys around the league. If teams are just going to continue getting bigger and bigger, playing more double big with skill and length and versatility, it's going to be hard for these smaller guys. Whether you're a Reed Shepard type or you're Gabe Vincent, it's tough in today's modern NBA, as big as some of these teams are. And the Warriors are not that big, but they do have some size and ways to exploit that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that makes Jimmy so valuable for the Warriors is that he's so physical. It adds a completely different dynamic to the Golden State offense. And I didn't list that in my list of Reed Shepard concerns, but that was another thought that I had, is like, how do you get away with playing this dude across a 7-game playoff series? Is he just going to be mercilessly targeted every minute he's on the floor, in some of the same ways that like Peyton Pritchard was targeted by the Warriors in the finals a couple years ago. And yeah, it is, everybody is getting so big across the league. And I think like the book is out, go get rangy wings and just let them harass people. And I will always have a soft spot for small guards, but it's becoming a tougher road to hoe in the modern NBA. There's no question.
Absolutely, is a lot tougher now. One other thought that I had from these two games last night is, you know, you see Jimmy Butler go off for the Warriors, and you're seeing Kevin Durant get booed by Oklahoma City. Did Kevin Durant make a mistake not returning to the Warriors when he had an opportunity last year? Because you think about KD, if he doesn't have a home in Oklahoma City after it's all said and done and he's retired, it just feels like there's no team that Kevin Durant is ever going to be associated with if he's not accepted by OKC, where he won an MVP and went to the finals and, of course, lost, but and then left for after his team blew a 3-1 lead and went to the Warriors. If the Golden State, since a short tenure there, despite two titles, despite a finals MVP, and then he goes to Brooklyn and Phoenix and now a short stint in Houston, KD, like, who is he associated with? And he had an opportunity to go back with the Warriors, and I couldn't help but think, maybe if he had said yes, it'd be Golden State and be part of that dynasty with two separate chapters. If he were there in place of Jimmy Butler, how great would things feel for him? Now, of course, he's in a good situation with Houston, but I just mean from a, you know, legacy standpoint, when you look back at KD and who he's part of and what culture he's part of, it just doesn't feel like there is one for him if OKC is going to boo him a decade after he left.
It's really tough because I think the die has been cast with Kevin Durant and his career and the lack of fans and sort of adulation that you would think a player as talented as he is deserves. And, you know, throughout history, most guys who are top 20 all time have had, you know, fans who are willing to like go to bat for their legacy for decades on end. I just don't know if that's going to be true for Kevin Durant. Had he returned to the Bay, I think that they would have lost and they would have struggled, and that would have complicated any sort of like Bay Area KD worship. I actually like Jimmy Butler better as a fit for what the Warriors are trying to do than KD at this stage in his career. And when I say the die has been cast, I just think he's had one of the weirdest, most frustrating careers of any great player in any sport that I've ever seen. And a lot of that was going to the Warriors the first time. And it is what it is at this point. But I think you look at OKC, I think OKC fans don't hate him as much as it may have appeared on opening night. I think it's just really fun to boo. And so it's fun to be at opening night booing Kevin Durant wherever he goes. But there's definitely no contingent of like cult fans that are just going to like lionize KD for eternity. And that's because of decisions that he made along the way. And it is what it is.
And we'll be right back after this break. It was also the NBA on NBC debut. Both announcer crews, first of all, I thought both were awesome. Play-by-play, Mike Tirico and Noah Eagle, both were great. I'm very much a fan of the crew with Tirico as well, Jamal Crawford. I'm a Reggie Miller fan. I know a lot of people don't like him. I just like his enthusiasm. I thought the trio was good. And then Grant Hill, really like him with Noah Eagle. Sideline, both Zora and Ashley did a good job, it seemed, as well. So I think the crew on the broadcast itself, great job. I'm very much impressed with the play-by-play. I liked it all.
Are we giving them an A-plus in the report card here?
Yeah, I think they get an A-plus there. I think they get an A-plus. Okay. Would you agree for the play-by-play?
I felt great. I felt great about the NBA on NBC. I mean, look, for me, I found myself during the pregame introductions and game one with OKC Houston thinking back to how small some of the finals games felt last year with ABC doing the broadcast. It just it did not feel like the broadcast for those games met the moment and reflected the stage that the NBA Finals is supposed to be. And Mike Tirico has the gravitas to make it feel like a bigger event and a bigger game. And I just thought, you know, the NBA and NBC jingle, that worked for me. Like, all of it was just excellent and so refreshing. And I even enjoyed the Michael Jordan halftime situation. I mean, they were basically interviewing Michael Jordan about why he agreed to do an interview with NBC. And he kept saying it's important to pay it forward for the next generation. And that was the end of it. And he told the anecdote.
The story about the free throw that he took at the house he was renting, the guy who owned it.
Which was awesome. I loved it.
It was so great. I was sitting on the edge of my seat.
And so, also substance there, but I'm in for all of it. I will watch every week Mike Tirico as they just drip, drip, drip every like 4 minute clip from Mike Tirico's sit down with Michael Jordan. So,
Do you think this one interview is going to last the whole year, or do you think this is like for Q1 of the season, and then they do another one?
I'm hoping it's a Q1 situation.
Me too.
Yeah, I do. I would hope that it's a Q1 situation. I mean, when they announced that Jordan was going to be joining the broadcast, I knew it was going to be like video hits from Michael Jordan, and I thought he was going to be like recording a new one every week. Should have known better that Michael Jordan's not going to sit down and just like pre-record takes for every single
watch
NBC
film
game.
Like Steve and Nikai at the dunker spot. You don't think he's going to do that?
Yeah, I mean, people were talking about like this is going to be MJ doing the Kobe Bryant detail segments.
No chance.
Who followed Michael Jordan's time in retirement,
he didn't even do that when he owned the Charlotte Hornets, Andrew.
I mean, look, Jordan is more concerned with deep sea, like bass fishing competitions and hanging out at the Ryder Cup and gambling. So he's a very busy man and is not going to be firing off takes every single week, new takes. But having him in the fold was terrific. And even if the 5 minute hit with Tirico was completely devoid of substance, he had me on the edge of my seat as he was talking about hitting that free throw in front of that kid at the house he rented for the Ryder Cup. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think there'll be some, you know, straight basketball conversation as well. This felt like the start of the conversation, you know, that we saw.
Yeah.
And, you know, Adam Silver had said in his Pat McAfee appearance yesterday that, you know, he knows he'll be asked about his thoughts on the three-point line. The NBC had teased how next week that he's going to talk about load management. So we're going to get MJ's thoughts on a series of topics throughout however long this interview lasts. I hope this is just one of like four or something like that. And there's something timely around the trade deadline, and then something around the start of the playoffs, and then something more like extremely timely during the playoffs. That's when it would be nice to get MJ's real relevant thoughts about series in April, May, and June. That's what I'm hoping for. But this is nice for during the season. I like it.
I'm very curious as to how honest he'll be, because I would imagine that MJ, one of the things that the NBA is emphasizing with their new broadcast partners is they want a more positive tone, which I think is a worthwhile point of emphasis. Again, when you go back to some of the ESPN broadcasts over the past couple of years, like Stephen A and Perk, guys who I can enjoy in small doses, the tone was just kind of a weird look before some of the bigger playoff games the NBA has had. So I think generally striking a positive tone is a good thing. But from MJ specifically, I do hope he is comfortable being critical where it's warranted, and we get his kind of uncensored thoughts on how many threes are being taken, what load management has turned into over the course of the last 15 years, because I think that would be really, really refreshing. And if he's just up there kind of spouting off generic positivity, which it seems like the league wants from its new broadcast partners, I would be disappointed. But the bottom line is MJ is so charismatic that I think he'll be able to make basically any segment work. That was my takeaway from night one and the initial segment we got from him and Tirico.
I think playing off that comment, that's sort of the way I felt with the pregame with Maria Taylor, Vince Carter, Tracy McGrady, and Carmelo Anthony, where it's like, I, you know, one of them needs to be a wild card who just says whatever is on their mind. It's just like not holding back, not being afraid, not that they need to be like hot take artists. I'm not saying that, but just spitting it out there. And like, you know, I think, you know, over time, it felt like Tirico, Jamal Crawford, and Reggie Miller have done a lot of games together. When they were on the broadcast, it felt like they've practiced a ton of games. I felt like the four here with Maria Taylor, Carmelo, Vince Carter, and Tracy McGrady was their first time. And hopefully they get better over the course of time. I think Carmelo, my first thought when that A block popped up, Carmelo not wearing a suit. He didn't wear a suit. Did he think it was a podcast?
Well, it's look, that's the thing. You got to make these feel like events. You've got to have everybody in a suit, their Sunday best. And Carmelo just shows up in the half zip or quarter zip there. Kind of a tough look. I agree, though. Yeah, I thought that because I watched the full hour before the opening tip, and a lot of that was pretty forgettable. So there's certainly some room to improve. And the one thing that you pointed out, I think you pointed out on Twitter, they didn't mention that Houston was starting with basically 4 7-footers and Amen Thompson, which is the craziest part of the game. And like something that anybody, casual fan or not, is going to be really interested to see and hear people discuss. And again, it was like a lot of platitudes about OKC trying to repeat this year. It's like, I was psyched to watch the game because I had no idea what the Rockets were going to look like and what that sort of lineup would imply. And so not addressing that seemed like leaving some low-hanging fruit on the vine. But again, game one, I'll give them time.
Yeah, absolutely. I could give them time, of course. I mean, ultimately, that would be the only real big note I'd have. It's like, I want to hear about this weird Houston team. And like, what does T-Mac and Vince Carter think about what this means for the future of basketball? Like some big picture stuff. It would have been nice to see. But, you know, a lot more NBC, NBA on NBC games to come. I was very impressed from night one overall. Can't wait to see what Amazon does as well. Let's talk about some games we want to watch from the rest of the week. I asked you to bring two of them that you're excited to watch. Andrew, what's your first?
First one is Spurs Mavericks. I cannot wait to see what Cooper Flagg looks like in a regular season NBA game. Wemby is a freak of nature, and his preseason numbers were so insane. I've given you grief because you're like a full-blown Wemby evangelist. I think some people are putting the cart before the horse with some of this stuff, putting him in the Hall of Fame. At the same time, defensively, he's already the best player in the league, and I want to see what his offense looks like, particularly without De'Aaron Fox. Like, he's going to have to shoulder a lot of the burden for that team, and I hope he's taking fewer threes this year, and I hope he's just getting into guys' bodies. And the Mavs front line, it's sort of like the JV Rockets. Like, they've got a lot of size. They're going to be crashing the boards a ton. And it's just going to be an interesting clash of two teams who are not the top of the West, but should be like firmly in the middle of the West. So I'm pumped for that. Are you going to be excited to see your guy, Victor Wembanyama?
Of course. So it's the game I'm most excited to watch on Wednesday night. I cannot wait to watch Victor versus Cooper. And also, the Mavericks have a strange team as well. And so I can't wait to see the way they play. All these reports about Cooper Flagg and PJ Washington running some point for them. I can't wait to see how they operate. Never mind. Like, how does what Victor did during preseason, where he looked like, as Kevin Garnett said on his podcast, Shaq and KD combined.
He did. He looked like Shaq.
He did. He looked amazing. But does that translate against Anthony Davis and this Mavericks front line? I cannot wait to see that. Because if it does, that's where Wemby, when you're talking about putting the cart before the horse. I think I was one of the first people in sports media to say Wemby's already top 10. But now you have a lot of outlets saying Wemby's already the sixth best player. Well, he still needs to prove it. He needs to show it over the course of the season. I might be the first to say he's top three, but I don't have him at six quite yet until he does it during the season. But it could happen on night one because this is a great test for him against Dallas.
That's what I'm reacting to. I'm looking around at some of the rankings lists that have him like in the top five zone, having never come close to making the playoffs. That's where I'm like, all right, can we all just please pump the brakes on Victor Wembanyama? He's a great defender. What's the baseline for you? Like, what's the bar he needs to clear this year in order to justify some of that hype?
Oh, I mean, I think it's pretty clear. Let's what we know about him offensively. Great shooter, all-time at-rim finisher. It's the creation. It's everything in between. What does he become as a pull-up shooter? What does he become on face-up drives to the rim? What does he become as a playmaker? If those are areas where we see continued rapid growth, as we have, he's a lot better last year than he was 2 years prior to that. If he continues improving there with increased usage in that role, that's where he enters that top three, top four conversation of best players in the game. That's where he enters the MVP conversation. And so I'd say it's precisely that. And what we saw in preseason was the Spurs putting the ball in his hands a lot, like a big, big pick and rolls, Luke Kornet sitting screens for him. Kelly Olynyk will be back at some point as well.
Some high, and then low small action. It's going to be great.
Yes. And small guys setting screens for him. I had Tyrese Halliburton on my podcast last week, and he had mentioned how the difficulty and Devin Vassell setting a screen for Victor Wembanyama, how that stresses the defense. And so I think him excelling in those actions, that's where Victor goes from less play finisher and more play creator. And all of the best players in the league are play creators, whether it's Giannis, Jokic, SGA, they're creators. And so Victor going from finisher to creator is the transition that'll have to happen for him.
Okay, so I note with interest that you did not lay out a win total that Victor has to clear in order to live up to the hype this year. I think
Victor said 6 seed, I'll say 7 seed. If they're in the 7-8, we're going to win one game to get in the playoffs. I think as loaded as the West is, that's incredibly fair. But I also think the Spurs, their supporting cast looked better than I anticipated during the preseason. I thought Keldon Johnson looks like he's due for a bounce-back year. I was pretty impressed by the way those guys look. Dylan Harper already looks like he's played in the NBA for years. Again, just preseason. But yep. A lot of reasons for optimism with the supporting cast around Victor Wembanyama. The game I'm most looking forward to besides that one on Wednesday night is Cavaliers-Knicks. The Knicks, strange last month for them because you have Mike Brown hired as head coach. He comes in talking about wanting to play with more pace and quickness on offense, spreading the ball around, and they do a little bit of that, and yet you look at the pace rankings during the preseason, and the Knicks were 31st in pace because they're facing some international teams. They were second to last among the 30 NBA teams. They did not play the way in which you expected. And then Karl Anthony Towns on a presser this week was asked, "What's your role?" And like, he looked dejected.
I don't know.
He's like, "I don't know." I don't know.
Not an encouraging answer from Cat.
What?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's pretty wild.
So I just can't wait
to
see the way the Knicks look, Andrew. What are they going to look like against the Cavaliers?
Do you have a pick for that game? What do you think?
I'll say Cavaliers win the game, even though it's in New York, because things just feel weird with the Knicks. Until they show me, I'll lean towards Cleveland right now.
Yeah, I'm a heavy lean towards Cleveland. And I think with the Knicks, a lot of people have been very high on the Knicks in the preseason. I listened to a number of over-under pods. Everybody's going over on the Knicks at like 52.5 or 53.5.
I would have been over before the preseason, Andrew. I would have been, but now I'm under. I'm worried.
I think I went on record as over on the Knicks on Greatest of All Talk like a couple weeks ago. Having seen the Cat quote, though, I now am going under on the Knicks. And I think my word of caution to the Knicks optimists would be, last year's regular season actually wasn't that enjoyable for Knicks fans. Like, it was kind of a bulky mess for a lot of that season. And they did win games and they had a ton of talent. And their performance against the Celtics was super impressive. Like, they played with heart in that series. They also definitely should have lost the first two games of that series. And the Celtics choked to an unbelievable extent in those games. And so, and then the Knicks also should have beaten the Pacers and did not have enough to beat the Pacers in the conference finals. So this team, like, they were getting shellacked by every good team in the NBA last year. Like, their record against the best teams in the league, I don't think they won a game during the regular season against, like, Boston, OKC, Cleveland, that class of teams. I just worry about the Knicks. I worry about Knicks fans, who I love. I think everybody is very, very optimistic, and I think the Cavs are probably going to provide a reality check on opening night, because the Cavs, talking about a well-oiled machine. I'm very excited to see Evan Mobley potentially take another half step forward and cement himself as a perennial All-NBA guy. I just feel much better about Cleveland than I do New York at the top of the East. Yeah.
I think that's very fair. You mentioned it's a great litmus test for the Knicks. I feel the same way about the next game I'm looking forward to watching this week, and that's on Friday, the Hawks Magic. I think these two teams, they've changed their rosters around. I look forward to seeing the way in which they both operate against each other. With Orlando, with their shooting, do they have enough of it? Is Desmond Bane and Tyus Jones enough? Atlanta, how do KP and this reshaped roster look? How do the second year and third year guys look at the wing position, especially Ricochet for the Hawks against an elite defense with Orlando? So I'm very, very looking forward to that game on Friday night. Andrew, what's your second one?
A Southeast Division battle. I didn't realize we were getting Hawks Magic that early in the season. I too am looking forward to that game, because I don't know what to make of either team, but they're going to be two of the teams that I watch most through the first month of the season to try to figure out what's happening in Orlando and Atlanta. So you asked me for my second game. You asked me to nominate Wizards Bucks for this segment. and so I can't, let me tell you, to the listeners of the KOC show, I can't in good conscience recommend that you watch a full Wizards game at any point in the 2025-2026 season. However, I am personally looking forward to watching Wizards Bucks on Wednesday night. Shout out to Shafty Bro. He was demanding coverage of Wiz Bucks on this podcast episode. Here's the thing. Wizards will be a complete mess. I am excited to see Trey Johnson. I think Cam Whitmore is going to be a fun bucket getter for the Wizards this year. A little worried about Bob Carrington. He had some hairy moments during the preseason. They traded Denny Avdia to bring Bob Carrington in. I would feel better about the Wizards if Denny Avdia was still on the team. Alex Saar, going to be kind of a grind this year, because last year he had some flashes, but kind of a mess defensively. He puts up counting stats defensively, but also frequently gets lost defensively, and is just kind of a frustrating watch. The Bucks side of that game, though, I look at the Bucks. It's like, I would compare the Bucks to the Lakers. The Lakers have a bunch of names on their team, but functionally, like, the team doesn't fit very well together, and they don't do the things, a lot of the names they have don't do the things that actually drive winning basketball. And I look at the shape of this Bucks team, and they're basically surrounding Giannis with shooting and defense, and they're going to have guys who can space the floor to let Giannis just eviscerate defenses and hit guys for kick out threes. And I think that formula, it's not going to lead to, like, a title for Milwaukee. Probably not even going to lead to the Bucks being in title conversations this year. But I think it's going to be kind of a fun Bucks season. And so I'll be watching. I mean, look, it still feels a little terrifying to say it's going to be a fun Bucks season when it's like Cole Anthony, KPJ, Miles Turner, who could be awful frustrating in his own right. It could break bad in Milwaukee, but I have high hopes that the Bucks are actually going to be kind of a fun ride this year. And I'll be watching to see whether those instincts are confirmed Wednesday night against the Wizards. I think it's going to be fun for the Bucks against the Wizards. It's going to be fun for whoever's playing the Wizards this year.
Well, in my predictions article, I had one for every, at least one for every team. My Bucks one was this season, the Giannis trade talks die. And I think that's because exactly what you said. The roster is, it will be fun. I think it's going to be competitive, especially in the weak Eastern Conference. I think it's going to be good enough that you're not going to see any midseason Giannis trades. Will it come back during the summer? I don't know. Like, we'll see how the playoffs end up going. But I think this team is going to be good enough to be competitive during the season, make the playoffs, and be competitive then. My one for the Wizards was, well, last year in the middle of January, they were 6-41 following just a disgusting 16-game losing streak. And then over the remainder of the season, they didn't lose more than six games in a row. My prediction for the Wizards was they don't have a losing streak that hits double digits this year. Hey, that's pretty good, right, Andrew?
I guess so. I'll take it. I remember, look, back in July, I looked at the Wizards' schedule and I was like, I don't see a lot of wins on the board for the first month of the season. So
watch
that
them
prediction
start the
may
year
age
0 and
poorly
10.
And quickly.
That prediction gone.
Yeah, exactly. I would be sweating if I were you, having put that out into the world. I'm looking at the schedule now. Not a lot of wins on the board. I think their best shot is Sunday against Charlotte, and I like Charlotte in that game. They got the Sixers next Tuesday. Beyond that, a bunch of teams that are just going to absolutely drill those guys. It's funny with the Wiz. You mentioned younger guys or smaller guys in the NBA having kind of a complicated future. The Wiz have gone the opposite direction, and everybody is like 6'7", 6'8", 6'10". I think Will Riley, the guy they drafted from Illinois, grew to 6'10". And so, and Keyshawn George is another guy I'm very excited about. But they do, I, as a Wizards fan, would implore the front office to add like one or two more functional guards to try to make sense of what the Wizards have in DC. And maybe they'll do that in the draft this year. Hopefully we get a little bit more lottery luck. Time will tell. But
Darren Peterson, Trey Johnson, backcourt of the future. That'd be pretty nice. Huh?
I've been eyeing Darren Peterson for about a year and a half now. This is where Wizards fans have been. We're planning out like multiple drafts into the future. So hopefully we get lucky and can add Darren Peterson. I am psyched for Milwaukee, though. I didn't know you would put that on record with the Bucks, but I feel the exact same way. And if you listen to Giannis's quotes, like, he's pretty jacked up and fired up about what the Bucks have. And the other day he was like, we're a problem. We're going to be a problem in the East. We're a dangerous, dangerous team. Love to hear that energy from Giannis. I hope he reminds people that he too is MVP caliber. And he was taking some hits on these ranking lists. He was like 4, 5, 6. I put Giannis right there with Jokic in kind of a league of their own relative to the other guys at the top of the league. So hopefully he provides a reminder this year.
I'd agree, especially if he's giving his all defensively, which he's fully capable of doing. Thankfully, I do not have any money on the Wizards not having a 10-game-plus losing streak this year because all of my money is on Reed Shepard. So
there you go.
Already in the red. Already in the red. Andrew, up next we have an interview with Ace Bailey. Had him on the show, so people should definitely stick around for Ace ahead of his debut for the Utah Jazz. I appreciate you joining me today, man. Please let people know where they can find all of your stuff.
You can find all of my stuff at stratechery.com, where you can get access to Sharp Tech, which is a podcast about technology, Sharp China, excellent, which is a podcast about geopolitics, and then Greatest of All Talk, which records twice a week and covers the NBA from top to bottom all year round. And I'm writing again now at a website called sharptext.net, and there will be some NBA takes up later this week. So a lot of content, but it keeps me busy, and it's going to be a very fun year covering basketball. Podcasting about basketball when there's not actual basketball being played can turn into a bit of a grind. So I'm very excited to have real games back in our lives, and it's going to be a fun ride here.
I know. I'm very, very excited. If game one of the season between Houston and Oklahoma City is not the best game of the year, we are in for an absolute treat the remainder of the season, because that was a great one. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me.
Take it easy, man.
We'll be right back. All right, joining me now on behalf of Black Ops 7, the star rookie of the Utah Jazz, Ace Bailey. Ace, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I want to start off with some basketball with you because your debut is on Wednesday for the Jazz. And I'm curious, how would you describe your game to somebody who's never seen you play?
Unique. I could say unique. I mean, I could do a lot of things from guard to 1-4. I mean, I can play to 1-3. Shoot the ball, take care of the ball. I can pass, score. I can create for others also, too. So I can say my game is all in one, unique.
I mean, you've definitely been doing a bit more creating in preseason, which has been impressive. And I think it's interesting as well, the way Will Hardy has been using you. You've been run through a lot of dribble handoffs throughout preseason. Mm-hmm. That's very different than what you were doing at Rutgers. Can you describe to me what's the benefit of using you with your skill set in dribble handoffs?
I mean, I can create my own shots, and also I can using me is just like I can get my teammates open up also, because everybody looks at me as a scorer. So once I got the ball, it's just like everybody looking at me. Or if I'm coming off screens, everybody's expecting me to get the ball, so that leaves someone else open, or that leaves me open. So it's a big plus.
Has the coaching staff emphasized looking for the pass to you? Like, has that been a conversation?
Yeah, just being more like overall, just learning the game. I mean, just knowing, being in the right spots, taking your time, making the right reads. Don't rush it. Let it come to you.
I mean, it's like interesting to see, because obviously you're a bucket. You can get into your own shot whenever you want to. And like the pass can almost sometimes open up scoring opportunities for you. Is that kind of what you've observed so far?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been through that. I mean, once you score a couple looks, everybody going to look at you and they give you a chance to kick the ball, make the right reads. I mean, that's when it says just take your time. Don't rush it, because everything will open up.
I mean, you're shooting the hell out of it from three as well. They're using you off of screens and handoffs, getting you into three-pointers and spot-ups as well. Do you plan on taking like a heavier dose of three-pointers compared to mid-range this year, or do you expect kind of your shot balance, to shot diet to stay the same?
I mean, I don't know. If it's the shot open, if I like it, I like it. If I'm going to take it. So it just depends on like what I see or what I read, or like to read or react to it.
You just see that green, right? Like no matter where you are on the court, right?
Yeah.
just a pure bucket getter, right? The way I would describe you. Like you said, unique. To me, like Ace Bailey, pure bucket getter. If you're a fan of basketball who loves 90s or 2000s, you'll love Ace Bailey. If you like modern basketball with big creators, you love Ace Bailey. Like, that's the way I look at you. Just a pure bucket getter, regardless of like your style of basketball. What about you? Like, when did you first fall in love with basketball?
I was very young. I mean, I grew up with basketball. I mean, my mom, my auntie played. So it was just like, I had to play basketball. I mean, after school, it was basketball. So I fell in love with it. I want to say eighth grade, once I found out like what the pros of basketball brought. Because I mean, me traveling, missing school for traveling on the weekends, leaving on Fridays, early Fridays to get on the road. It's fun. I mean, I ain't like school for real anyway, so leaving on a Friday was fun for me anyway. So it was just like just having fun with it, enjoying it, bonding with my teammates, getting to know the teammates, and also seeing places that people would probably never see in their lifetime. So I looked at that as like, man, I could really do this. I could really take care of my family if I take this serious, and I fell in love with it ever since then.
I mean, it takes her around the world. Well, what's the coolest place you've visited so far because of basketball?
Man, I can't even name one place. I mean, almost all the places I really haven't been yet, I would say basketball haven't took me is L.A. It's crazy.
It hasn't taken you there yet for like no high school competitions or anything?
That's the only place I haven't went. I went to San Francisco, but I haven't went to L.A. That's the only place I'd say.
So you've been to New York City. You've been overseas,
yeah,
right?
I've seen all of I've seen the big stages. I've seen it all.
Wow.
I ain't seen it all, but I would like to see it all. But I've seen a lot of it.
I mean, with Lakers and Clippers, you'll at least have multiple games there every season at this point. Playing right?
Yeah, that's my teammates say. I told them they couldn't believe it.
I mean, that's pretty cool. I mean, I feel that too. It's like, it's really cool how basketball just like in the media side of things, it just brings you places. It brings you around the world. So like with you, it seems like you're pretty young when you first kind of had that seed planted in your brain to want to become a professional. But like, when was the first time that you felt like, oh, I actually have a chance. Like, I can be an NBA player. When did that first happen?
City of Palms, my senior year of high school. The competition we played against, I mean, me being a McDonald's All-American, all that opened my eyes up to, like, not everybody sitting in these chairs. Because if that was the case, everybody be in the league, and that's not the case. So I looked at that, and I just thought, like, bro, I'm in these chairs that the greats done played in. So I have that opportunity. It's like I'm in that spot. Like I'm in that chance, the opportunity of getting to the league. So it's just like that hit me. I really want to say McDonald's because like everybody can be a pro, but like not a lot of people say they sat in them seats as McDonald's All-American and be like, they went from there to the pro. So that, I took that serious.
So prior to those moments, it was like just kind of those dreams,
those big camps, big moments. I kept saying other big names. It was like, okay, I'm here with them. I can be here also. I mean, I can be there in the league. I mean, so it's just like all that just opened my eyes.
Who are you most looking forward to playing during your rookie season?
I mean, I played against them already in preseason. KD for sure.
Was KD your basketball idol growing up?
Yeah, for sure. I watched a lot of his game. I mean, my game is his game, low key. I mean, it hit me a moment. Like, one of my teammates was like, bro, y'all just did the same move. He did the little spin fade. Not the spin fade, but the spin on the little spin jump shot creation. I came down, did the same thing. And it was just like, bro, I didn't even realize. It's crazy.
Now, when you're, like, adapting a move like that, are you watching YouTube videos and then going out and practicing? How like, what's that process like for you?
It's just the trainers. I mean, they see the same thing. I mean, also I see the moves. Sometimes you know how you're a kid. You're going to the backyard and be like, I want to do this. Let me try this to add this to the game or add this to the bag or whatever. So all that played an effect in it.
Now, I'm curious, like, obviously you have a deep bag as is, but if there's a move that you could download into your own game and you'd have it tomorrow, what would that move be?
I really got all, like, I got to perfect the mid post. That's my goal, is to perfect the mid post.
Why is
perfect
that?
Perfect that. Because mid post, it ain't that far from the rim. It ain't hard. It's easy. And it ain't too much. I mean, get to your spot and just rise up or get to the rim. I mean, it's not that hard. Just read and react to it. I'll see what the players give you.
I mean, it's interesting. I think like, this preseason, it's been a story in Minnesota. Anthony Edwards is trying to install that into his game. And it seems like been a focus for him this preseason. He's, you know, shots haven't fallen yet necessarily, but it adds a new ingredient to the floor. And I think like in this era of basketball, it's very hard to guard. And I think this era of basketball, it's like rims and threes for a lot of teams, but the mid range is still crucial for star level players. Like, where do you see the value in the mid range as a scoring weapon, as a playmaking hub in the NBA?
If you watch basketball, you'll see a lot of bigs being dropped. So, it's all different reason reacts. I mean, I love the mid post. I feel comfortable getting it there. I feel like that's the go-to. I mean, once you get that in the bag, it's really too much. It ain't really too much. You don't really need, mid post is just, nobody don't want to take it. I take it. I love it. I should have mid-range every day if it was up to me. But it's fun. Just get into those spots. It's not that hard. You ain't got to shoot far. You ain't got to. It's simple. Nothing too hard.
So you would just take 100% mid-range if it were up to you.
If it was up to me, I'd take a little bit of again.
Even over a dunk?
Not over a dunk.
Okay.
Dunk bring the energy.
Did you say you'd take away the three-point line?
I'd take away the three-point line. We go back old school.
You would get rid of it.
I'd get rid of it. It was up to me. But no, it's a good thing. It's there.
All right, so like if Adam Silver said, Ace, we need to install some rule changes in the NBA to further increase popularity, you would suggest getting rid of the three-point line.
Yeah, but I don't think Adam should be coming to me right now about that.
Just a rookie, right? Got to earn your stripes.
I got a long way to go.
You mentioned how, for you, you've traveled a lot. Utah was a place you didn't necessarily expect to go. What have you loved about Utah the most ever since you did land there?
It's great views. I mean, from like sitting around, the mountains look good. I mean, it's very different from where I come from. So it's like just being here, sitting in the mountain views, hiking, golfing, doing stuff I ain't never thought I'd do. It's fun. And I actually like it. Like I'm getting into golf. I ain't never thought I'd play golf. I'm getting into it. I actually like it.
Is that Danny Ainge and Austin Ainge getting you into golf?
Yeah, they get into it. Yeah, we all went golfing as a team one time. It was fun. It's like team bonding. I loved it. I mean, 18 holes. It was fun.
Well, the team owner, I think him and Danny like to golf together as well.
Danny liked to golf.
Yeah, I mean, I knew Danny when he was in Boston years ago. Like that dude lives on the golf course. So I'd imagine with you, it's kind of nice to see. Are you good? Are you getting good already at golf?
I'm getting there. They say I got a good swing for a beginner, but who knows? They might be lying.
they just want you out there with the mountains. Yeah. I went to Utah for the first time a year ago and went to Zion National Park. Did you go there yet?
No, I haven't went there yet, but I've been to Park City yet. That's where we went golfing at. It was beautiful.
Okay, I mean, it's like it's absurd how beautiful that state is. Mountains everywhere.
Very, it is.
The air is so crisp as well.
It is. That too.
When did your like perception flip? I mean, because I'm sure for a moment there's like disappointment. And then when did it turn to excitement?
It's been exciting. My dream was just to be in the NBA, no matter where it was at. It was just to be in the league as a kid. So hearing my name called, it was amazing. I mean, so I landed off the plane. As soon as I got off the PJ, I was just like, look at the mountains. It didn't look real, like a green screen. Like most people that come here be like, don't even look real. It's like a green screen, but the whole time it's the mountains.
Do you feel like the love for Utah that you're starting to develop factored into your decision to move on from your agent, where it's like, okay, time for a clean slate moving forward?
I don't know. I feel like once my teammates just play in effect, everything, just getting out here, just, I don't know. It's just, it fell in love with who I am truly. So we're just having fun with it.
And I'm curious with you, like in your NBA, what are some of your motivations as a rookie? What do you want to accomplish this season?
I mean, of course, rookie of the year. I mean, that's the main goal for all of us rookies, is just try to win that. So that's a big goal of mine. I mean, I want to be an all-star for sure. I mean, just got to keep putting in the work. I want to make defensive team. So the defense been working. Also, just become a better teammate. Be open to learning a lot more. There's a lot of stuff out here I didn't know. I'm learning.
Like, what's
some things
you didn't know?
Like new term, like new words. Like words be different. I mean, from like how easy it is. It's just basketball terminology for real. I didn't ever know. I think that I know, but I know.
I'm going to give you one goal, because or at least something I hope to see, because earlier this week on my podcast, I did bold predictions. And one of the bold predictions I had was related to you, because 2009, Brandon Jennings scored 55 points. That's the last time a rookie scored 50 plus points in a game. That's the last time, 09. So I said this year, Ace Bailey scores 50 as a rookie.
We shall see. We shall see. 55 is a lot. Salute. That's crazy. As a rookie too, also.
I know. Trae Young had 49. Blake Griffin had 47. Like, pretty hard to do, obviously. But, you know, you definitely very have hard. Everything in your bag. So you never know. It's very possible.
Very hard. It is hard.
What do you love most about basketball, Ace?
I mean, how it brings people together. I mean, it brings people together from, like, different cultures, different worlds. I mean, it's just... it brings a lot of people together that have the same passion. And I just, like, they all want to be driven, whether it's taking care of someone, whether it's just traveling, whether it's just having fun. It's all getting to know new people through the game of basketball and, like, what they likes and what they don't likes. So I can say that part of it.
What do you love most about Call of Duty?
Killing, shooting people, having fun with my teammates.
What mode do you like the most?
Really, like the part I said, just get bringing my teammates together. All of us just bonding on the game. We all doing something that we like to do. Just play the game.
Multiplayer, zombies, Warzone.
Multiplayer, zombies. We play the zombies. We play multiplayer sometimes. Multiplayer, I get carried. They ain't that good. I got to work on the aim a little bit. But other than that, it's just mostly just zombies or like multiplayer. We have fun with those. Just whether we're just cussing each other out because somebody didn't have each other back. But the whole time, it's just bringing us together on the court also, too, though. So that's what I like, the bonding over the game.
Do you trash talk against the opponent?
Yeah, I trash talk. I mean, of course.
So you're on, like, that open mic.
Sometimes. It depends. It depends what mood I am. If I'm in, like, let's get on the mic. Or if I'm, like, frustrated, real mad, I keep dying, I'm turning the mic off. I get mad.
Someone starts jawing at you. That gets you going.
Yeah, you terrible. Yeah, they start talking about basketball. They, your aim is just versus your jump shot. I turn off.
Who are your teammates that you play with?
Sometimes I play with my teammates back from Rutgers. I play with DG, Dylan Grant. I play with Bryson. Sometimes I play with Sfee. And that's it, for real. Try to play with Sfee.
Nobody with the Jazz yet?
Nah, not for real. I ain't even know Sfee and them would be on Call of Duty like that, for real. But, hey, you learn.
I mean, hey, man, I'm excited to watch you this season, Ace. I mean, I feel like you landed in an awesome situation. Veterans, bunch of good young players like Walter Clayton. Dude's unbelievable in March Madness. He already looks good. He's impressive, man, right?
He getting comfortable. I mean, he looked good, too. So all of the plays affect Pauls. I'm sorry.
I mean, Walter Clayton in March Madness, he looked like Steph Curry, the shots he was hitting, right?
Crazy. He be hitting them at practice, too. That's the thing.
He hit shots like that in practice?
Yeah, he hit shots like that in practice. That's the part, I mean, that blows your mind. Like, he's consistent with it.
I mean, like, he was hitting those shots with, like, minutes left in the game. It was just crazy.
I was watching. It's crazy.
I mean, clearly Austin Ainge has a type, drafting you and Walter Clayton in the first round. Yeah. He likes bucket getters. He likes guys who can score from anywhere on the floor at any moment. So I can't wait to watch the Jazz. He's one of the brightest futures in the NBA, Utah Jazz, and Ace Bailey. Appreciate you joining me today, man.
No problem. I appreciate you.
Big thank you to Andrew Sharp and Ace Bailey for joining me on today's episode. I'm going to be back tomorrow, Thursday, with another podcast. I got Spike Eskin, Kirk Henderson, and Jonathan Macri talking about some of Wednesday night's games. Looking forward to that podcast. Thank you to Emmy and Dakota for producing today's episode. Thank you to Father John Misty for the music. Thanks to you for giving us a listen. See you Thursday, and then we get a lot of games to be played the rest of the season. Have a good one, everybody.